And where's the chair gone?
I'll put it on the shrine there
Oh,
next to you.
So now that from transitioning from Bodhileela's chair to Amalavajra's chair, and I'm just going to say a few words about Amalavajra, which Subhadasi referred to a bit in his talk about Amalavajra has a wealth of life and Sri Ratna experience that you bring to the WLBC, and particularly Sri Ratna Right Livelihood experience. And after you had your, actually the other day we were talking about going on or off the rails in our spiritual life, and Amalavajra started his youthful career as a bond salesman in the city, and then he went on the rails, he found the Dharma. We won't go into what Mai's experience was. And then he worked for Karuna Trust for quite a number of years.
13 years.
13 years. And then he spent 11 years at Future Dharma Fund, so another Tru Ratna organization. You were ordained in 2005. Maitreya Bandhu is your preceptor. And he also has a master's a master's in charity marketing and fundraising, which you put so beautifully to use at Future Dharma. And yes, here we're going to make the most of it. And you've lived for many years in various Sri Ratna communities in London and elsewhere. And as Bodhileela said, he originally started here. Had a blink of an eye as men's Mitra convener. It was a bit like that, wasn't it? It was like, Mitra convener, no, wait, he's the chair. And he's already starting. It's been lovely working together with Amalavajra, starting to plan out programming for how we can continue to help this Sangha thrive and grow, building on a lot of the networks and relationships that Bodhileela has put in place. So whether it's people of color, local people, experienced practitioners bringing in new people, and also a new project that Amalavajra has brought in that he's weaving into West London Buddhist Center. It's called Trackless, which is in particular helping bring younger men into the Dharma through stomping around the mountains of Snowdonia. Of course, isn't that obvious? I won't write you marketing copy for that. But as I say, I really have loved working with Amalavajra for these past months. We met each other maybe 18 years ago briefly at the LBC, but it's just been really, really great to be around someone with lots of energy, lots of ideas, and also clear, 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 clear. Let's get on with it. It's nice. And yet there's also this creative side that you're just open to listening to different experience. You know, you're coming into, you've never worked in a center
No.
before. So your learning curve is like this in that regard, and being open to listening. So and just as Bodhileela was saying, when you step in as a chair, there's all these things that I don't know how to do that. But being open to, let's just see what I can do. So,
Okay, guess I really am the chair of West London Buddhist Centre now. Thank you very much. It really has, although I was appointed by the trustees in October, I really knew that it wasn't real until we'd done this ritual. So I really reminded yet again of the power of and the importance of ritual. Thank you very much, Bodhileela, for words you said and the ritual that you led up earlier. Well, and indeed for everything you've done for the last 7 or 8 years. When I was writing your card, I was realizing that you've really left the Sangha in a really lovely state for me to take over. You talked about that some of the harmony or the disharmony that you had to work through and the harmony that you created, and the lovely sense of friendship and friendliness that's here. So I'm really, really grateful to you for giving me this. I don't know if this isn't anything I was going to say, but anyway, a canvas to paint on in a way. Like I was just saying to Norman on the stairs, like everyone needs a project, and this is a really beautiful project. I'm very grateful for it, actually. I've had a couple of years where I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. I'd sort of retired, so to speak, from fundraising and Future Time. That had been my thing for years, for decades even. And okay, what next? And actually, you've given me this, so thank you very much. I'm really grateful for a project, a meaningful project to engage with, work with you all. I'm about to say what we're going to do together, hopefully. But I really, yeah, I think everyone needs a project, don't they? And I certainly do. And what could be more important than this? So, yeah, I wanted to go big, first of all, and think about the universe. Okay, I wanted to start with that. I don't know about you, but I always have the idea that I want to stand and look at the stars. And of course, you get those opportunities, especially on retreats, to stand and look up at the stars. But I don't know if you ever have the experience I have where there's both an attraction to that and the beauty of looking up at the night sky, but also, like, terrifying, yeah. Like, I kind of often find I can't do it for very long. It's like this, does anyone else relate to this? Like, you just can do it for a few seconds or, if you're lucky, a few minutes. And you either start naming the constellations, which is one way of avoiding the experience, or just think, okay, that's enough, I'm going back into the warm. You know, so I also think that's really interesting. But to invoke that, you know, as you know, the stars that we look up at are just a tiny fraction of the suns that are out there. I looked up the figures this morning. They all seem to grow every few years. They say, actually, we thought there were this many galaxies. Now there's this many. But the current number is that in our galaxy, that the Milky Way, there are 100 to 400 billion stars, and therefore solar systems. So solar systems like ours, just in our galaxy, 100 to 400 billion. And then that this galaxy is only one of 2 billion galaxies. So, you know, in terms of actual solar systems, like the one that we call home, yeah, billions and billions and billions. In fact, there's some quintillion number that they have, but I don't know about that. So you've got that, and then you've got the sheer scope of time, of, you know, and the fact that I'm sure you'll know that many of those suns that you're looking at don't even exist anymore because, you know, it's taken so long for the light to travel across space. And then and then just the sheer amount of time that's taken even on this planet for the Earth to form, for then life to develop, and then, of course, human life. So when you look at it in that sense, well, the Buddha's quite close to us, actually. Although 2,500 years ago in a very different part of the world, different culture, actually not so far away. And the issues that that people faced then, the issues of dukkha, of suffering, okay, we've got slightly different variations on those, but remain the same. I mean, I could mention a few, I guess. There are, of course, the inevitable sufferings that we know of just of being born. You know, the Buddha talked about suffering of birth, the suffering of death, and indeed of rebirth. But within the life, you know, of aging, of sickness and death, of the aging sickness of death, of all the people that are close to us as well, that we experience, and we've experienced in our Sangha just over the last few months. And then I guess those are the sort of inevitable sort of sufferings of life. And then the sufferings, of course, that we sort of create through our mind and through our actions that come out of our mind, in a way, through our own foolishness, you could say, and other people create for us through their foolishness. Those kind of sufferings. And then even, you know, there's these three levels of suffering that the Buddha enunciated, and even that most subtle level of suffering, which are just the suffering of kind of conditioned existence, where even if you're lucky enough to be in the phase where everything's going really well, everyone you love's well, you know, you're in good health and, you know, generally life's going well, even then that sort of almost existential suffering of, yeah, but it's not quite it. There's something more, there's something beyond this. And knowing, of course, that things will change if you reflect on that. So this is the kind of universe we seem to suddenly find ourselves born into. And yeah, okay, the Buddha 2,500 years ago, he found a response to that. He found even a solution, a resolution of human suffering. He said many, many times when people threw metaphysical questions at him, I'm only interested in suffering and the cessation of suffering. So that's the kind of lineage that we find ourselves in. Sangharakshita back in, what was it, in the I think it was the 30s or the early 40s, discovering he was a Buddhist and always had been, going out to India for 20 years, training with many teachers, and then coming back and founding Truratna Buddhist Community, or Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, as it was then, in 1967 here in London, in Covent Garden. Some of you will know that. And then everything follows that, and then the lineage of, 1974, I don't know if you know this, but West London Buddhist Center effectively started in 1974. Vangisa started classes in the Quaker meeting rooms in Ealing. So there you go, that was the start of where we are now, or so to speak the start. I mean, as I'm trying to explore, the start goes back well beyond that, but that was the start of us. So in a way, so it's actually 50 years now since what we're enjoying now first started. Although, just for the record, what's normally taken as the absolute start is when Kamala Sheela took out a lease on the first ever centre, which was 1976. So we're planning to celebrate our 50th anniversary in 2 years' time. Another, actually going through the lineage, so I've been finding out who are all the different chairs, you know, and some of them you'll know more recent times. But there was, in terms of Jnananda, Paramananda, Sahananda, Moksha Raja, they're not in order, by the way, but and I think Paramananda twice, actually. He was immediately before you were saying. And the various centres they've been, I mean, say centres, one was like a Montessori centre just off Oxford Street, one was somebody's flat in Hampstead, one was originally a burnt out kind of house, some of you might know, near Portobello Road, which apparently had been the digs for the Motorhead roadies, which was burnt, which they set on fire apparently. Anyway, with even darker stuff, which we won't go into, but you know, but like, you know, that was the centre for many years. Then Westbourne Park Grove, is that the right? Villas, thank you, Westbourne Park Villas. And then 10 years ago, actually, apparently, you were saying it was December 10 years ago we came here. So this is actually spot on 10 years that we've been here. You've been here, I say we, I've just arrived. But you've been here, we've been here. So here we are, that is that lineage. I'm the chair, but of course we're all part of going back to the Buddha and his resolution of human suffering that we're trying to find for ourselves. And here we are celebrating Sangha Day. It is very late. It's supposed to be the full moon in November, but people are on retreat and all that. So there was the retreat at Astana, then there was our retreat and various other retreats. So here we are celebrating a late Sangha Day. We wanted everyone to be able to come. Which, by the way, actually, just on a personal note, it was Sangha Day 25 years ago, 1999, that I became a Mitra. That was at the London Buddhist Center. So nice little look. I certainly never thought then I would be actually running one of these centers in 25 years. Never occurred to me. That was Sangha Day 99. So what is Sangha? So I want to explore what Sangha is. If you'll forgive me, I'll introduce a personal element as well, which might also give you a chance to kind of get to know me a bit if I talk about my journey around Sangha. But maybe it will relate to you and your journey around Sangha as well, because maybe you have some sense of, well, you've got a sense of us, and you've got a sense perhaps of the, for some of you, of the refuge tree of the great figures of the past, the great Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the past, which in a way is the Arya Sangha, but the noble Sangha of Buddhas and so forth. But yeah, just want to explore a bit the journey that you might be on around Sangha and spiritual community. And maybe I'll help you access that by talking a bit about my journey of that as well. So, and I think I've got to come up with a little model. I think there are four stages. You can come up with lots of models. But I think there are four stages you could describe going through in terms of Sangha. And I'll take you through those. The last one is the most mysterious. And I'll do my best. And it involves Padmasambhava. So I'm very glad that we invoked Padmasambhava. Thank you. I do live with that mantra. First three, but easier to talk about. The first one, very easy to talk about, because that's first come to Sangha. And I would say that you're probably, when you first come to the Sangha, when you first come to the Buddhist Center, and certainly for me, when I first came to the Buddhist Center, this being, well, various ones, it was actually Kathmandu was the first one I came to, but properly started coming to was London Buddhist Center. And it was purely out of, quite understandably, I wanted, I wanted to grow. I wanted to change. I wanted to develop. You could call it, you know, it was a wish for self-development. I'd done a lot of that kind of training in America with, you know, self-help and so forth. And I'd seen the limitations of that. And, but, you know, I'd learned through it. So I was very moved by my experience of meditation and contact with the Dharma in Nepal. So that was my driver, but very much in the terms of what can it do for me, if you like, you know, how can I be happy? I really got the wrong end of the stick with the nature of enlightenment, because I thought, oh, right, see, the Buddha doesn't suffer. He's untouchable in that sense. He can't be touched by suffering. That sounds really good. I want that. So that was, frankly, you know, fair enough in a way, but that was definitely my motivation. Like, how can I basically suffer less? How can I just be untouched by worldly suffering? You know, just the suffering of being alive, the kind of thing we've just been talking about. So in I'm also going to mention a sort of a particular kind of mental state or emotion alongside each of these. So this is Atma-sneha. Atma-sneha. So Atma means self. You might be familiar with that. Atma means self in Sanskrit. And sneha, which is a wonderful word. Sneha means cherishing, like sneha. It's like self-cherishing. And I know it gets a bad reputation, self-cherishing and that sort of thing, but actually it is the basis. It is the starting point. It's often taught, actually, as a starting point for metta. You just basically got to have enough concern for yourself that you do care about growing, about developing, about, yeah, you know, about becoming a fuller, wholer, more fulfilled person. That is a basis, which I'm sure, obviously, you all have. That's why you're here. So that very early stage is you know, that's in we couldn't promote the center of marketing. We couldn't promote the center by saying, come into the center to serve the Dharma for the benefit of all beings. Like, people that just wouldn't work. Instead, how we have to market the center on the whole usually is, come and learn to meditate. You're stressed. Come and, you know, meditate to kind of learn a bit, experience a bit of calm, and you know, just enjoy life a bit more. You know, that's, you've got to meet people where they're at. So I think that's perfectly natural as one's first stage of engagement with the Sangha. Yeah, basically based on your individual wish. Obviously, the downside of it is one will tend to relate to the Sangha as a kind of consumer at that point. You know, like, I come in, I pay my money, it's a bit confusing then because they say there's no price, and that's confusing. But anyway, it's just dana, it's giving. Okay. Anyway, so you just come in, and this was certainly my attitude back then. You just come to get the goods, you know, get the good meditation. That's why I used to come, just to get a good meditation. And then hopefully no one would engage in too much and I could just get back to my life. I quite liked the fact the LBC was so massive because, you know, there's so many people there, 80, 100 people at a class, because you could just sneak in and out and you wouldn't have to sort of engage with anyone. I did wonder if at some point they would say, look, this is a Buddhist center. You've been coming for a while now. You do kind of need to get into the Buddhism. You can't just keep dropping in to do the meditation. I'm glad to say nobody ever said that to me, to my surprise, actually. And that period went on for 3 years. So I was a pretty slow starter. Yeah. You know, I was selling bonds in the city and just wanted to be rich. That was my main goal. So that I would say that would be the first stage of engagement with the Sangha. Very much sort of almost like consumer, getting what I want and then heading out the door. I'd say the second stage is I guess you could call it the positive group. Sangha actually uses this term, doesn't he? He talks about group and the spiritual community, where you start to actually make friends. You start to feel, okay, there are people here I recognize and people I like and people who recognize and like me. And then it becomes more than just, yeah, that more consumerist attitude. And of course, you're all at that stage. And for me, that, and I don't know how it happened for me, it happened from going on a retreat and then being invited off the retreat to come in and join a group that was meeting. This was way before becoming Mitra or anything. It was just joining groups. So, and suddenly I realized, oh, people know who I am and they're noticing me, and they'll kind of notice if I'm not there, you know, if I'm, say I'm going to be there, I'm not, they'll actually notice. So that was a really important stage for me. And of course, then we're getting into this, the engagement with the Sangha of what you have metta, you know, it's of actually taking interest in other people, they're taking interest in you. It's gone far beyond just transaction to, yeah, beginning to friendship, spiritual friendship. I think obviously that's a very positive thing. But there's also a sort of slightly near enemy of that, which I do want to mention, which maybe you've experienced. But I think sometimes when we really feel we found a kind of refuge, as hopefully you feel that here, we've got friends, we've got practices we enjoy. Often people talk about this as a kind of second home or a kind of refuge. That's wonderful. And the risk of it is that it becomes a little bit inward looking, if you sort of mean, like it becomes about us, which it is. It is about us. And here we are talking about, here's me talking about us, the Sangha. But I think it can be a limitation if we stop at that. And then if you imagine someone just ringing a bell right now and they come off out the street and they come in here, they would just think, oh, these people obviously all know each other. This is obviously a thing. This obviously isn't for me. I'm not, this isn't me. And they'd probably walk right out again, which isn't to say we shouldn't be doing this, but it's just a real thing to look out for, I think, in any Sangha, is where it feels a bit, almost a bit cliquey. Obviously, we're not a clique, because a clique's trying to keep people out. We're not trying to do that. But do you know what I mean? That would be, I think, the near enemy of Sangha at this stage is where it feels like a bit of just a group. And I think we all have to watch out for that. Even like many of you volunteer on teams, talking about volunteering earlier on, it's a real tendency, like, we'll want to talk to our friends. I just did it in the tea break. I was chatting away to Norman, and you know, like, of course we want to do that. And it's so hard to think, actually, no, let's turn outwards to the new person who I don't recognize, who's just come in, or, you know, like that. That would be an example of that, of sort of working against that very natural tendency. And we do need to spend time with our friends. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but, you know, also remembering to turn outward to newer people. And I think that's when we start to get into the third stage, you could say, of the Sangha, really as an altruistic project that's reaching out to the world, you know, to everyone who's living in West London, not those who've already found their way in here. And obviously that's Sangha, I was going to say, in a way, it's a Sangha proper, where we're working together to reach out to others. And again, speaking personally, I think that stage came when a guy in our study group, that group I told you about, who's now in the order, called Satchidasa, he said, hey, I've heard about, I've found this Lido in Brixton, where they said we can run meditation classes. And Maitra Bandhu, who's leading the group, he said he'll teach it. How about we all go and put it on? You know, how about we all go and do the promotion, the publicity, put out all the cushions, da da da, all that stuff that has to happen every Tuesday night, we'll do that. And I was a bit reluctant, to be honest. You know, I was already doing my one night a week, which was Monday night, and now he wanted me to come Tuesday night. you know, other things. I probably had salsa classes or whatever I was into at the time, you know, like, but I did do it. Maybe that was positive group pressure, I don't know, or something higher. But anyway, I said I would do it. So we went down there. So there's me in my suit with my sort of city overcoat, handing out flyers at Brixton Tube Station. And if you know Brixton Tube Station, that's a bit out of place, you know. So that's what we did. And then I remember, and then waiting outside the Lido, because there was a big dark, there was like quite a, it was winter, so it was dark, and there was quite a path from the main road to the actual Lido building. And so we lined it with these candles in little paper bags to light away. And then we because obviously we were a bit scared, like, you know, what's the way? So we would wait out front to kind of welcome people in and lead them into the shrine room. So I wasn't, not a shrine room, it's just a, you know, community center. But obviously I wasn't teaching or anything, but I just, even doing that by kind of helping light the way, if you like, into the room and show make people feel at ease, I think that was karmically extremely significant. And actually that coincided with me making a big shift to taking the Dharma seriously as something that could, well, that was more than just a hobby along with salsa, you know, the rest of it. That was the big, so I think what I'm trying to say is, obviously it was a benefit to those people who came through the doors of Brixton, which now is a thriving Sangha. But also, it was a benefit to me personally. Like, suddenly I was not a consumer, and not even just a group member, but actually I was a real, well, I was a benefactor, but I was helping put this on for other people, you know. So I think that's a really important stage. And I know most of you, if not all of you, will be at that stage already. Many of you here are volunteering quite actively. But that was a really crucial stage, I think. And say, maybe it was at the level of karma. I don't know. I mean, they say it's very karmically significant to share the Dharma, to spread the Dharma, to give the gift of the Dharma. It's said to be the greatest gift. So, yeah, I think that is a really important stage, that third stage. And I mean, this is what I mean, what I was trying to say in a rather uneloquent way. that you've created, Bodhilila, is you've really created that culture of people wanting to work together freely. You're giving their time to share the Dharma, and that's what I, that, if I had to sort of say in one sentence what I particularly want the next, well, I've said I'll do this for 5-10 years, but however many years it is, that's what I really hope, is that we reach more and more people by working together. We share the Dharma, we invite with more and more people, we invite more and more people into Sangha, not for its own sake, but for the sake of their growth and development, and indeed yours. So I think that third stage, yeah. And I would say the emotion that goes with that is, of course, karuna, compassion. We don't this wonderful gift that we found, we don't just keep it to ourselves. We share it out of compassion for anyone else who wants it, who will respond to it. And then you've got the fourth stage, the very mysterious stage, I guess I can do my best to point to, and hopefully Padmasambhava will lead us towards. But this is the stage of sort of spiritual community proper, if you like. And Bhante Sangha actually talks about the Sangha as a free association of true individuals. Some of you might, if you've met Trisha, have come across that, but it's the true individual. The true individual is basically a stream entrant, someone who's made decisively entered the stream of the Dharma. Their progress to enlightenment is absolutely assured. They're not enlightened yet, but it's clear. The bodhicitta has arisen, as they say. The bodhicitta being the mind or the heart of enlightenment has arisen. And what we're taught here is that the bodhicitta is not something personal that I get, which of course wouldn't make sense, because if the whole point of enlightenment is transcending self, transcending narrow self-interest, or even transcending ego, whatever phrase we want to use, it wouldn't make sense that I gain enlightenment or you gain enlightenment. Clearly it's something transpersonal. And Bhante goes as far as to say in the Bodhisattva Ideal that it's actually far more likely to emerge amongst a Sangha, amongst a number of people practicing the Dharma together. Yeah, it's quite a statement if you think about it. It's going to arise, more like to arise, where there's people working together for the benefit of all in this context. That's where it's going to arise, rather than you or me or anyone else off on our own doing our little meditation. Important though that is, and our solitary retreats and whatever retreats do, but actually that's where it can arise. And I went to an event at Adistana a few weeks ago where maybe I had a sense of that. Definitely not saying I got enlightened at Adistana the other week, but I went to this event that was the celebration of the completion of the complete works. Some of you might know that Sangharakshita's complete works have been published over the last 8 or 10 years. Number of volumes, almost 30 volumes. Incredible work, lots of editing work and fundraising work. I was involved in the fundraising at the beginning. And it was it's finally done. In fact, I just had an email yesterday saying that because I get all the volumes, they've last set have just been delivered or about to be delivered any day now, including a concordance as a reference to everything Bhante ever taught, which seems extraordinary. So I'm huge. I'm doing this because I think it's like a huge volume. Anyway, we'll have it here in the center. You can see. But point being that it happened to take place at the same time as the College of Public Preceptors. Okay, so that the College of Public Preceptors, they're the ones who basically are responsible for the spiritual health of the order and movement. They're the people who've been deeply involved for decades and decades. I mean, you know, been ordained 40, 50 years, many of them. And, you know, if anyone's done it, if anyone's really put the Buddha's teachings or Bhante's presentation of the Buddha's teachings into practice, it's them. You know, they've really just given their lives to many of them, if not most of them, yeah, working literally, you know, working that almost all that time, if not all that time, for Triyana, for the Dharma. So I'm in a room with about 50 or 60 people like that, and we're there celebrating something that a whole group, some of them public preceptors like that, some like me, just others who are helping. And I've got to tell you, the atmosphere was really very special indeed. It really was very, very special indeed. This sense of certainly harmony, kind of unity, of purpose for the good, and celebrating something that we'd kind of brought into being between us over these 8 to 10 years was very, very special indeed. And I know it's hard for me to communicate that, and I can imagine it's hard for you to imagine that, but like in some sense I felt I touched into the depth of their collective practice. And I suspect that enlightenment is a bit like that sense of this complete freedom from, well, from yeah, in a way, from me and mine and my stuff and my projects and my worries. There was none of that. For a little while, there was none of that. Just part of this extraordinary assembly of absolutely dedicated practitioners. And I'd be very confident there are some true individuals in that room. I'd be very confident indeed. Yeah, that was a very, very special experience. So that's what I hope, in a way, for us here, that we can enter into the path to that kind of experience and that kind of depth of practice. That's what I really hope for. You were talking about, you know, and I hope, you know, if there, I know there are people here in the room training for ordination, there are people in the order. I really hope more and more people might feel that draw as well. Obviously, it's fine at whatever level people want to engage with Tretna and the Dharma, but I'd love to see more and more of that over the next 5-10 years. So Padmasambhava, that thing I'm describing can only happen in the service something much greater than any individual. And Padmasambhava is the figure I'd like to invoke here to finish with. Padmasambhava, as most of you know, will know, and you mentioned, is known as the second Buddha, in, at least in the Tibetan tradition. The second Buddha, the great teacher, the great guru, the precious guru, he's called. He's also very famous for traveling to Tibet at a time when, at the request of someone called Shantarakshita, who was trying to build a monastery, and the demons kept pulling it down. And that feels rather apt here in this center. Let's not blame Thames Water, but maybe it is them. Thames Water and the demons of Thames Water and the ancient drains. But I learned recently that actually even in the old center there was a major flood as well, right? That happened, you know, where apparently there's a massive flood where it was so significant that three ceilings came down. The water came because someone had left a tap running or something on the top floor, went away for the weekend, and just all floors came down, all three floors, ceilings, you know, the place was absolutely, you know, flooded. So there's something of a tradition, which I hope we can stop now, of flooding the West London Buddhist Centre. You're welcome to look downstairs if you want later. They've actually now ripped up the floors of, it's quite a point in a way, but they've ripped up the floors of the main shrine room. You can see that. We're going to see whether anything else needs to be ripped up or not. And we'll see the extent now more clearly of the damage. There's something very apt about Padmasambhava went there at a time, you know, the monastery kept getting pulled down. Every night the builders would build the monastery, and then nighttime the demons would come and tear it all down. And it took Padmasambhava to go there to actually, well, it said, pin down the demons. He pinned down the demons. Actually, apparently brought them into service to the Dharma. So it would be wonderful, wouldn't it, if we can, whatever the demons are that have been assailing our Sangha this year, if they can be put to the service of our Sangha. So Padmasambhava, and he's also known as he's known as the true spiritual friend. And you mentioned spiritual friendship. That is the lifeblood of any center. Like if a center's ever not working, it's because spiritual friendship's not flowing. And if any sangha's ever doing really well, it's because spiritual friendship's really flowing at all levels. Whether it's meeting someone brand new off the street just with a really friendly, warm welcome, or whether it's someone ordaining, you know, someone or really inspiring them in the deepest sense, that's spiritual friendship. And Padmasambhava is known as, yeah, the archetypal spiritual friend. He's one, you might notice a lot of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas don't necessarily look at you in their images. They're looking down or they're looking to one side. Padmasambhava looks right at you. He looks right at you. And he's said to look at you with a wrathful smile. And it's easy to think, you know, with our Western insecurities that he's angry with us. He's not angry with us. He absolutely loves us. But he's saying, look what's going on. And he's holding these... these really strong symbols of the nature of reality, very strong symbols, very challenging symbols of nature of reality. I mean, for those of you not familiar, in his right hand, he's holding this vajra, this inner demon-slaying mudra. He's holding this vajra, which is in itself is a symbol of reality. He's holding a skull cup. Now, can you imagine what a skull cup? Yeah, it's literally made of a skull. So someone's died, there you go, and he's turned that into a cup, or someone has. But in it is the amrita, the nectar, yeah? The nectar of, in a way, you could say everlasting life. But anyway, this sweet nectar of, let's say, enlightenment is in that skull cup. So that very symbol of death, of impermanence, is holding the nectar. He also, of course, has his Katvanga, this trident in his left arm, in the crook of his left arm, and it's got three skulls on it. One of them is a freshly severed head, one of them is a rotting head, and one of them is another skull that's, you know, thoroughly gone. So, like, this is not kind of nicey-nicey Buddhism. You know, this isn't garden centre Buddhism or what's it called over there, flying tiger. This isn't flying tiger Buddhism, gift shop Buddhism. This is, you know, they're not going to be selling an image of Padmasambhava over at Flying Tiger, I'm confident. He is the figure that we've decided to adopt next year as our... Padmasambhava is going to be our Buddha next year, our sort of presiding deity, you could say, is going to be Padmasambhava. Or Mahung, yeah. So, because he is, yeah, he's the guru of transformation. He's the true spiritual friend. And I think that's, you know, I think he's the figure who's going to help us enter this fourth stage, you could say, of Sangha, of this something, you know, genuinely transcendental, in the sense of transcending ourselves. The bodhicitta arising, transcending ourselves. That's always got to be our goal through all these four stages of Sangha, through the stage of the more individual search for just sort of self-development, that second stage of, yeah, you know, positive group friendship of metta, and then the third level of reaching out to the world with compassion, really, really reaching out with kindness and compassion to the world, to a suffering world. Yeah, that's where Padmasambhava hopefully is going to take us. Is up into that fourth level of Sangha, sort of transcendental Sangha, the transcendent Sangha. So there you go. That's what we're going to do this year. And from there, we'll see what happens next. And just on personal, thank you. I really appreciate such a warm welcome from you all, and that you've all made the effort to come here and celebrate this day. It's very, very deeply meaningful to me, as I said at the beginning, and I look forward to getting to know you all better and working together, yeah, for the benefit of all. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm a Samovar,
No, he's definitely he's not there, is it? No. Somewhere.
Thank you, I'm the Bajra. Wow, yeah. What an inspiring way forward. And we have two thank yous. That's the first one.
Oh, thank you very much.
This is Andy. He's our
center manager. Yeah, yeah.
And then we have your chair.
I have my
flowers. And we also, on behalf of the team and the trustees, we have
treasure chest.
A little treasure chest. We need,
yeah, that would be great. Thank you very much. Shall I open it now, or is that a...
No, it's not Christmas. You can open it now.
Okay. Oh. Wow. Wow. A Vajra bell, for those of you who don't know. Yeah. A Vajra bell.
Ringing the changes.
Sound of wisdom. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Oh, great. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Yeah. Yeah. Ring it. Okay.
It's much better than that bell out there.
Oh, it's a wonderful sound, isn't it? Lovely sound. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, on that note, time for lunch, everyone. Thank you all for coming. We do hope people can come back. At 2:15,
yeah.
We'll hear from some people who do volunteer here, and we'll also have a ritual. And
should we say who those people are, in case that?
Well, Kadi, who's just run out of the room.
Yeah.
Because she didn't want to be rumbled, and George, who isn't quite here yet.
And Dharma, not today.
And Dharma.
No, okay, but the other two, yeah, good, yeah, good. And